would have thought that that allowance field would go 21-3, 21-4. Instead, they let Buchanan Hollow go 22-1. Well, then the race was over, because then he goes comes 22-4, 24-1 the rest of the way. You can't catch him, even though the other horse was trying to get him. Well, it's not that scientific. You could just figure who's going to be in front, what it would normally take to be, and then that you just let it rest on that. I will project what the race should go in. For example, that race should have gone in about 109-2. It's par. Well, it goes 109-1. Now, I know that. If a horse is 4 or 5 lengths off of that, I generally will not even entertain that horse if he's that far off of that final time. But if he's any closer than that, the shape of that race, the makeup of that race will dictate whether or not I include this horse in the play or not. And oftentimes, I mean, when all the front runners decide to stop and they also possess the best final time ability, well, then some horse that could be 3, 4, 5 lengths off the projected final time is going to pick them all up because they're going to be so tired. And the race will come up slow. And then somebody that doesn't know how to make variance will say, well, then that race will make the variant based on those horses that quit. Therefore, this horse gets an enormous figure. Well, that's not the way it works. The race was slow. And that's one of the dangers in making your own variants or subscribing to anybody else's variant that doesn't know how to make that. Because some of those races just do come up very slow based on the pace of the race, and you can't change the final time to account for that. You just have to understand that that race came up slow.
You know, that'd be the same thing as in the race yesterday, that In Excess and Dance Floor and all those horses. In my wildest dream, I would have never thought that in the mud that they would run a 44 and change at the half mile. You know, more like 46, 47. This race, here's four horses that cook themselves and set it up. Only way that Strike the Gold can possibly win the race, set up for him to win. But, you know, a time of 44, here's other people trying to beat this 44, these other guys trying to beat the 44, and Strike the Gold right, running like he normally runs. He don't care what they do up front. Let them cook themselves, and he'll pick up the pieces.
This one's for you, Jimmy. And I waited to ask it until Tom came by. They want to know, that do you think that Tom Renner's APV formula would be improved if you divided the result by the number of horses in the race?
No.
I divide the amount they won by the number of the horses in the race.
Yeah. That was a joke question, Tom. That really wasn't, that wasn't real.
Incidentally, Tom Renner's telephone number is area code 818-5...
And
if you're
from out of state, okay, we have two requests. We have one gentleman and another two people who thought that your presentations were so good yesterday, Tom, and yours so great yesterday on EXDC, that they would like you to repeat the entire day now. Since we can't do that, folks.
No, we're going to do it. In fact, I'm going to take 1 minute to summarize my whole day, and you take 1 minute, and we're off to the race book. Can't do that, of course.
No. But Joe Ray has taped everything, and for those who wanted a review of Tom's sprint to route to sprint, and how to use the confirmation screen, a confirmation screen in Thoroughmation, I'll just answer it this way, is like a confirmation letter. It confirms what the Thoroughmation screen did. And the first one you see is called the confirmation screen. And it's right every time except when it isn't. And then the other one's usually right. So you have to, if you model and see what's happening, like Bruce told you, if he does it his track, you'll have a good... I think only I can answer this. Jimmy wrote the program for me, but he's not quite sure what it's supposed to do yet. Tom was the inspirer of this program, but he doesn't know what it's supposed to do yet. But once we clue them in on it, they'd be able to answer it. Do DC pars work well with shippers from tracks with an opposite bias, or if track surface speed is slower and faster? If you do DC pars the way Sam Wada did them from the Dream Race, yes, they do work. If you are making DC pars specifically pars for your track and your track only, it would be just like velocity pars. No, they would not compensate for shippers, but they would compensate for a different bias. But they would not compensate for shippers if you're keeping a static number for your track. So, if you have the DC par program and you want it to encompass all this, do it the way Sam Wada did it, which is the final section in the manual here. It's so well written and explained by Sam Wada that I would not presume to try to improve upon how he did it. That's the way to do it for shippers and stuff. And then Jimmy's now writing the ultimate program, which I'll explain to him what it means. See, he's a wonderful programmer.
I haven't got past DC Pars yet.
Well, I sent him the formula for this.
I got some more formulas on DC Pars.
Yeah, he'll get it done. And when you're as good as Jimmy, folks, it's pretty tough to get a guy to use a program that's supposed to make you better. All DC Pars is to help you get the right contenders and get it down to bare knuckles of who belongs in the race, and to be able to pinpoint who's going to win place and show. Jimmy, well, maybe you could use it for place, but Jimmy knows who's going to win and show almost automatically. Jimmy has a favorite saying, I'm a no one in this race. And when he says, I'm a no one, you better know he's a no one. If he says, I'm not known, but I'm going to bet on this one, then you know you better be careful.
I just Dutch his win horses in the show pool. Collect them both. Ugly scan.
Ugly.
We had a program like... Oh, that was Ultra Scan, wasn't it?
here's a program that I'm going to handle very, very...
You appreciate beauty also.
I'm going to handle this very gingerly. The man thinks that one of our programs, is user-unfriendly. And he wants to know if the new programs are more user-friendly. Thermation and Synergetic Matchup 2, the various programs of Thermation and everything. Are they more user-friendly? Folks, Spencer Toner would be very happy to demonstrate any of these programs for you. What is user-friendly to one person may not be user-friendly to another. To me, they're so friendly, I love them. I will agree that our old programs, the ones that encompassed prior to the new formats, were not as user-friendly as they might have been, but that was kind of on purpose. We wanted to make everybody suffer.
Let me comment on this. Most of the advanced programs I do right, and I make them as user-friendly as I possibly can. You can move through these programs and go almost any place that you need to go. Only thing that you cannot put into a program is the human factor. The human factor is, if I work 90 years on one program, somebody would screw it up or find something that didn't work the way that they thought it was supposed to. I know that there are certain problems. Someone called me about it locks up on the projected pace on the EXDC. Why it does this, I have no idea, but it'll only do it on a 386 type computer. I don't have a 386. You know, I have a 286. It doesn't lock up on a 286, but it does on a 386. But most of the time, most of our programs are more user-friendly than they have ever been. If you take the time to go through them slowly and get to find out more about the program and how it works, then you will become more of a friendly user.
Oh, boy, an admin. You become a friendly user. Never mind with the program. Listen,
I wish I'd have worn boots.
Too late now.
It is.
I make a lot of money using these programs in betting horses, and I find them very friendly. And once in a while, something will hang up, and it says, computer just exploded, turn off and on again. And I'll turn it off and on again happily. The thing to do is, when it says save race to disk, the first time it says it, when you hit the Q button, save it to your disk, and then if something goes wrong, you've got it, and you don't have to re-enter it. Folks, the money... Ask Tom Renner, in all seriousness, what? The kind of money you can make with the program that's supposed to be user-unfriendly.
All you want.
You really can, folks, so you got to remember that...
It's only as friendly as you make it.
The guy is more interested in the convenience, which is what user-friendly is, convenient to the user, is missing the whole point of what we're making these computer programs for. We're not trying to rival Lotus 1-2-3 or one of those big companies that make software. We're trying to give you a tool to win at the races. Now, the only guy who worries about it being usually friendly is usually someone who can't make it work, even if it were friendlier. So let it work for you and make you money, and it'll suddenly seem much more user-friendly. All right, gentlemen, now that we've rationalized our failures, what factors do you consider the most important in evaluating a horse's performance? Pro and cons on what he can do today. Give two or three factors. You can't give them all.
Recent improvement. Profile, track profile suitability. Matchup of the race. I do subscribe. These guys chide me, but I do subscribe to the bounce theory. And we had an example in one of those races that someone else did yesterday, and a horse running too well off of a layoff sequence. Because a horse runs very, very well off of a layoff. Generally speaking, they're overbet second time. Don't run quite as well. And the third time overbet, and the third time when they come back, they're usually underbet and do run back to their potential. I look for that pattern. I also look, I mean, I really don't like to see a horse run a life, you know, a lifetime best last time, because generally speaking, they're not, you know, people fall into a danger. If a horse ran his lifetime best last time and you use that as indicative of the horse's performance, you can get into a little trouble. On the other hand, if the horse's other races also qualify the horse as a top horse, that's a different story. So you got to be a little careful not to just zero in on the best race a horse has ever run, because they don't, I mean, that's why it's the best. Just like you, you have a best performance at something, and your other or your normal performances are slightly less than that. And that's what I—that's why I seldom look at one single race and say that that is what this horse is. So I like to see a horse that's consistently as good or better than the field.
I might use a bounce if I knew what it was. but I don't, you know. I thought it was kind of like a dribbling a basketball or something. No, all kidding aside, the matchup. How's it, this horse going to match up against today's pace? Or how's it going to match up or with the other horses in the race? Is this horse, can he carry his speed all the way? If not, then is some horse going to come as a, that is pressing the pace or off of the pace that they're going to win the race? I'm like Tom, I do not like horse's best, lifetime best on his last race. But, you know, sometimes they do repeat.
Especially a young horse.
Just like I didn't expect Dixie Brash to repeat that last race in the Metropolitan Mile. I did not. I thought that the horse might place. But I didn't think this horse would go wire to wire. And it ran faster than it had ran in its last race. As 3-year-old going against 4-year-olds. Yeah. You know, it's just, I'm going to win more races by ignoring Dixie Brash than I am betting Dixie Brash in the long run. And, you know, that's your goal, not just one race.
I agree with that. I bet Dixie Brash in the Withers. And I was not in town, so I wasn't betting, but I probably would have avoided him in the Metropolitan Mile myself. You know, I agree with that. But he is a young horse, and he proved that young horses can do some phenomenal things.
Only thing, and you know, here's a horse that's got to go wire to wire in a 44 and change, and you got good horses that come off of real fast sprints in excess. Should have stopped him from going wire to wire, but he didn't.
Okay, one person asked four questions. I'm going to answer the three of them real fast and then turn the other ones over to you guys because it's a real good question. So
those three answers are yes, yes, and no.
Well, almost. we're not going to slap the person off, but I'm going to real fast. And the subject of body language. What is the Sartain methodology opinion of body language? We don't have any. If you can do it, do it. If you can't, can't. We once recommended Joe Takich's method because it's numerical, and those who can't perceive body language can use it. In psychiatry, you're taught to read what they call the language of undifferentiated local signs, which is nothing more than body language. I was very good at that, but I'm very bad at horse body language, so I don't try to use it. If you're good at it, use it. What are the pros and cons of going to the track, going to off-track center, or going to Nevada Racebook? Which do you prefer? It hasn't anything to do with which I prefer or which they prefer. Where do you do your best work? Where do you feel the most comfortable? The pros of going to Nevada is you can play 9 tracks. The off-track centers, the pros is you don't get your pocket picked as readily, and you don't get shoved around, and you don't have quite as much, and you don't have the parking problem and all that. It's where you feel comfortable. Some people love the racetrack, and they don't function well unless they're at a racetrack. So do whatever makes you the best. How do I become more proficient at selecting the ugly horse that invariably runs second? You stay awake during last night's session on this. And if you missed it, it's in the manual. And if you still miss it and don't get it out of the manual, Joe Ray has the tapes. Now, the same person asked a very good question, which we will answer in detail. When both the husband and wife...
Hi, Leroy, you here?
Is Shirley here?
They're outside tearing them slops.
Get Leroy. Oh, if you get Leroy and Shirley...
Shirley's
on,
probably out at
good.
The pool by now.
Are each more or less equally proficient handicappers? Of course, these guys would never admit that, the macho guys. Which is the best betting strategy to use to maximize profits, making a unit bet or bets or making individual bets without really discussing it? This is a good question. In my opinion, making... Well, they're going to give the answer. In my opinion, making a unit bet or bets tends to reduce the influence and or confidence of the more subordinate partner. Oh, I think maybe a woman wrote this. But I'm not certain if that's the best method to use to maximize profit. All right, gentlemen. Tom keeps his wife 5 feet behind him. Jim said he was going to do that to his wife. She heard the tape, and now ain't no way. So how do you and Leroy do this?
Let me start. I don't have a wife that plays the races. Those of you that know my wife know that she walks 5 feet behind me, right? She's 5 feet in front of me with cash in her hand. I do have a comment on this, and it's not so much... It isn't necessarily husband and wife, although it applies. I have found over the years that anytime two people get together and handicap a race, what you wind up with is you wind up with one of two things. You either wind up with the worst of each, or you wind up with one dominating the other. And if my wife played the races along with me, I would separate the bankroll and let her play, period. Because if we talked, I would influence her betting. And she wouldn't influence mine, but if it were the other way around, she would. So I think you should keep it separate. There's no reason not to do that. A unit bet will drag the worst from both of you. I can almost guarantee that. You're right. She's tough.
Answer Jimmy was going to give before, he can't give now because Leroy just walked in. So check him out on this.
You know, I would have said the same thing, but I'll tell you this: I would agree totally with Tom, with a husband and wife handicapping, is that it'd be very, very difficult to discuss, well, I have this horse and you have this horse, which we're going to do. I don't know that unless you really just sat down and got the contenders and the pace lines and worked them together and came up with the same horses, could you share a betting. Now, Leroy does not handicap. And she goes to the track. She will put them into the computer so that we'll have a printout. She bets her own money. She has her own bankroll and bets her own money. I may influence how much she bets on a particular race. But, and I've told her, you know, if you're going to go, I'm not going to hit every race. And you're going to have to realize this and learn this. But overall, that we will win. And day in and day out, we'll come out ahead. And I'm not going to influence her. Or she said, why should I learn to handicap? You know, she has pretty good confidence in what I can do. And, you know, why should she learn? I said, now you can put them in the computer. And it's going to, if it shows up at horse 1, 2, and 3, and the computer gets them, I have the right to supersede the computer. I like 3 better than 1. Now, she may go up and bet the 1. That's her prerogative, but then I bet whichever one that I so desire.
Jimmy and I, my wife, what her idea was, I always brought her $100 after the races, and now she's... says, well, why wait? Why don't you give it to me before you go to the race?
Yeah, that Leroy wanted to know. You know, that same thing Howard told me. Said, now, when you start going to races, said, go in and give your wife $100. And I'd go in and give my wife $100. Now that she started going to races, she wants to know if she still gets her $100.
The closest thing I know to a married couple betting, even though we don't kiss, is Bradshaw and myself. And we don't influence each other.
This is getting into some very sick territory.
Very sick. 2 or 3 times a year, Bradshaw and I go on like a husband and wife team and sit next to each other, cuddly at the track. And our language is like this. Bradshaw goes, Like he's pointing something to me. And I say, yeah, I saw it. And we'll do that at the racetrack. And no conversation, just And maybe, golly, Hart, see that? Gee, Jimmy, do you notice that? Yeah, I know. That's our whole conversation. And how we bet, we don't know. I never ask him, he never asked me. I know about the 1-3 tickets he piles up, and exactly, but other than that, I don't know. I just know that he's always coming away from the window happy, and I know that at the end of each day, the people at the book are looking over their shoulders every time we collect, so I guess we're both doing pretty good. But that's what I would call, you have to have that state of harmony with each other. It's almost like sex, incidentally. It is. If the sex is good, it's a kind of a union.
I told you this was going to be sick.
But since Jimmy and I are over that hill, this is kind of substitute sexual activity, but it has that same flowing rhythm to the moment of climax, which is going to the window.
Talk about your ugly horses.
Now, I'm not doing that talking. That's hair.
But just remember, as Father Keller always says, a family that plays together and wins stays together. Okay, guys, how do you evaluate horses coming from over 6 months layoffs? I don't look at the date. That's how I do it. Tom?
Well, I mean, it's tricky. I mean, you're guessing every time. Statistic, and I don't argue with this statistic because it's true. Any horse that hasn't been out in 30 days, there's a negative impact value associated with that. Every time a study's done, it's that way. But not every horse that's been away longer than that loses. It's strictly an intuitive thing. I mean, if you know the trainers on your circuit and you know that they can bring a horse back ready to run, we have some in Southern California, you have somewhere everywhere else, then you can support the horse. If the horse shows in its past performance that it has run well off of a layer, you can reasonably support that, assuming it was still trained by the same person that trains it today. It's very tricky. I try to evaluate the workouts as much as I possibly can. I mean, I want to see a 5 or 6 day workout pattern leading up to this race. I don't want to see all 3 furlong works, for example, because then you can kind of assume that the horse isn't ready to run. It's really tricky. I mean, it's like projecting a sprinter into a rut. It's a guessing game to a large extent. I feel a lot safer when I don't have to attend that horse.
You know, when a traditional handicapper like Tom will tell you something of this nature, that it's tricky and that you don't know, what I tell you shouldn't surprise you that I ignore it. Mm-hmm. And if the horse is capable of winning at today's race, sure, it's like a sprinter stretching out. You may be right, you may be wrong. And this is the reason that the Sartan methodology says bet 2 horses. You know, if he becomes one of your horses, then bet 2. I think if, due to the matchup, I think that the horse has an opportunity to win, then I will bet the horse. That's the way I handle it. Because, you know, I don't know. Yes, it's risky. You know, 60 days can be risky. You've got to assume that these trainers know something, that maybe they've been at least partially getting the horses ready. Someone asked, do you use workouts? Time-wise, no. 4 or 5 furlong workouts, 6 furlong workouts after a layoff. Yes, I look at those things, especially on layoff horses, but generally I ignore dates.
Good, that answers the next
one. One quick point here. On horses that have been laid off for a while, the ones that I tend to support, if I'm going to, are horses that had gone off form prior to the layoff and have obviously been freshened because they'd gone off form. The ones I don't like to support are horses that were running in very good form and then go to the layoff, because then I'll assume there's an injury involved.
Yeah, I would. That's a good point, Tom.
Here's another Carmack question. People track model and profile. Anybody want to know what the question is? No, that's close, but do you like one more chance?
Track Ronan.
Huh? Yeah, precise. You get the prize. Mary, have you got a IBM type computer?
No, I haven't got a computer.
Well, when you get one, we'll send you a free GraphTrax program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It has to do with the fact that it rains considerably in the summer at Calder. It rains considerably in the summer at about half the tracks in the United States, New York, Midwest. It rains at all these tracks. And they want to know if there's any tips to how you should play it. Yeah, you should play it according to your profile, according to your own observation. If you send us some races, we could tell you how it's running. You send me a week, 2 days of results charts, I'll tell you right away how it's running. But I'm sure you can do that with all the information you've had about profiles here.
You know, I think that if you say that the Calder, or you say this track, it rains almost every day, or it rains this way, it runs that way, and how can you keep a track profile? Personally, I do not keep a track profile. I rely completely on the matchup. I think that if you look close enough at the past performance of the horses, that you've got a model and a profile of what's winning at that track, regardless of the shape that the track is in. Rain, mud, whatever. You know, you've got lines if it continuously rains that much. I played Santa Anita out here last time we were out, I believe, and it was raining and raining and raining. Now you're going to see how that track really runs in past performance of these horses when you look at them when it is raining at Santa Anita. I think down in Dirty, you can just look at your racing form and get the information that is needed for a track profile and a track model.
What's the first race of the day? That helps too. Go to the next one.
Oh, you want me to comment on it?
What if you want to?
Well, just very briefly, I just play a lot better when I have the profile available to me. And every time I play around it and if I should not keep it up to date, I don't play quite as well. So I'm dependent on it. It works for me and I use it. This is the first year at Santa Anita in a number of years that I kept a separate profile for the off tracks because we had a lot of rain this year. And so I did that. I mean, if I played at a racetrack that got an awful lot of rain during the summer, I would keep a profile for those rainy days so I know what I'm looking at the next time around. So, I mean, that's the way I would approach it.
There's questions that have to do with the subject of recency, which they've just addressed. And then there is the subject of pace line. This person heard comments that some people always use the last pace line and some go back. Tom Brohammer wrote in his book a very good thing, that at one time he was a stickler for the last pace line or without one heck of an excuse, but he's learned to be more relaxed over the period of time. Now, I want to give one answer to this about this last pace line. Some of our people claimed huge, magnificent results using just the last pace line for every horse. Do 20 races sometime, folks, and just use the last pace line for every horse, religiously, without any other considerations. Do it and see what happens to you. Tom?
No, I agree with that. I mean, I want to say that I say every time is that you have to address the last pace line because that's your indication of current form on the horse. Now, the horse that Jimmy liked yesterday, Chigger's Revenge or whatever, Chigger's Chance, I agree completely because that's the pace line that I zeroed in on when I was watching him perform do his thing up here. And that was way down in the past performances. I just agree completely with that pace line. So, I mean, but you have to attend the last one. In the case of this horse that he was looking at yesterday, this was the horse's third race back after a layoff. The first one was kind of poor. The second one was a marked improvement. So now you got an improving horse. You talk about how to anticipate improvement. Look at that manual. You see a definite improvement in the horse's second time. Generally speaking, the third time back will be the best of will be one of his best races.
Is that bounce?
No, that wasn't a bounce. No, wrong one. But anyway, that was an improving horse, and that pace line was a long way down. But it was absolutely the right pace line to choose.
Go over that race, because we explained the rationale for that pace line. And always bear in mind that Jimmy did look at the last race, and that race proved the horse was in condition. That's what Tom's talking about. Look at the last race. But the person who told you how much they won just using the last pace line, we don't have to say that they erred or that they were fudging. Do 20 straight races and use only the last pace line for every horse yourself and test it. It's so simple, because that's a rule. And if you come out with more than 8 winners, send me your proof and I'll send you a free program.
I've evaluate the last line. That's what the horse is doing recently. But just because it is a bad last line, why was it bad? You know, evaluate.
Evaluate the pro and the con, good or bad.
This is addressed to me, but it should be addressed to everybody else. Doc Sarton, what's the best way to determine if a race will run early or late? Well, this is the language is a little bit mainstream. The matchup you get on the screen I use, which is the kinetic generator screen, tells me whether it's going to run early or late, because it tells me how far ahead the earliest horse is of the other and how much the other horses have a chance to catch up. I determine it by looking at third fractions. It's a down and dirty way. What third fraction can this horse run? And if somebody who's going to be in contention with him can run a much faster third fraction, and he doesn't have to come from way off, because horses that come late is a bad word. Late means you've got to run around a whole lot of other horses, and you can't guarantee that ever. So it's got to be a horse that's in contention who's going against an early horse who cannot sustain its third fraction relative to today's matchup. That's how I determine if we're going to run early or sustain, not late. Late is for the Kentucky Derby. Jimmy?
Not much answer. Elaborate on that. It's just the mix
about that matchup.
About the mix and match of the horses in the race.
Well, me, I just assume the first race is going to run early, and the other race is going to run, the last race is going to run about 5 o'clock, which is late. I just, that's silly. I just agree with what they said. That's all. Whoa.
Where's the
No, I just agree with what they said. You know, the first race is a great indication of how the race track is going to run, assuming that the matchup can dictate the way that race ran as opposed to the track.
Okay, this is a question that's loaded too, because it's using a lot of mainstream. How you wager on an early track? Well, you mean a track where at a distance where it is favoring earlier horses. If the race has two superior horses that are closers. And I don't like the word closers, because closer doesn't mean necessarily mean that they are in contention. They just close. So if you're talking about if you have two superior sustained pace horses running in a race where they normally run win early, if that's what your question was, yes, if these horses what you call closing horses are horses that maintain faster third fractions are usually horses of greater class. Races that are won by closers are usually class races, stakes races, a longer distance, because the higher the class the horse, the more it sustains its energy through the end of the race. Your lower class 3-year-old filly races are usually won by earlier horses, because once these kinds of horses are headed, especially on the turn, they give up. So it's the matchup once again, and it's the class of the race that determines whether closers win. The class of the race, the horses that sustain the energy the longer are usually the higher class horses. Tom, if you agree with me on this, I'm going to go home so delighted.
I agree.
I'm going to brag to my wife. Tom Brohammer agreed with me on something.
Mary, I agree.
I agree.
Let's all give Mary another round of applause.
Yay, Mary, stand up.
We are fond, and Dick Schmidt is fond of making great gestures about the pace line looming up at you. And my son said, when they asked you, why'd you pick that pace line, he says, because it looms up at you. And I've used that line once in all seriousness, saying that once you developed insight, the correct pace line would loom up at you. This person calls us on it. If you had to select one factor that helps you choose a pace line, what would it be? What factor makes that line loom up at you?
Today's race, the conditions in today's race.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at this race and this is an early setup, you look for the early race, that horse's ability to run early. And if it sets up as a closer, you look for that horse's ability to run as a closer. They probably won't do both, so you can eliminate him one way or the other. But today's race is what's going to dictate what pace line. And current form. Remembering we can't just ignore the last out.
Total agree. Just looms up.
I don't know how else to express this. I mean, it's a matter of doing thousands and thousands of races. You just zero in on it eventually.
When I first started, I didn't have the wise counsel of people like Tom and Jim. Really, I was alone. And I thought that just picking the correct pace line was the most mysterious thing in racing. And when I started being able to do it correctly, I never wanted to verbalize it or tell anybody what I did because I afraid it would go away. Because what I was doing was kind of, I wasn't exactly praying, but I was saying, I'm visualizing. When I open my eyes, I will see the baseline I should use. When I open my eyes, and I would hypnotize myself, and I go, bing, there it would be. And I hit it real hard. No, I'm serious. This is what I really did, because I thought it was a mysterious thing. And then I found that these other people could do it. And then I figured, well, maybe it's what it is. It's intuition coming from practice. And I think that's the only reason we get the representative. There's no right baseline. The representative baseline, because of practice.
Yeah, there is one criterion you should apply, though, and that is if you make the horse a contender. I mean, you should not frivolously make a horse a contender. Once you make a horse a contender, then it's up to you to find out the race that you decided to make him a contender from. Because if you don't make a horse a contender and then choose a bad race, why in the hell did you make it a contender?
Right. The words of Tom Brohammer, if you're not willing to bet that horse you put in there when it comes up, don't put it in there. That's the wisest thing. One of the wisest things you've ever said.
Yeah, otherwise it's an exercise in futility. Why do it?
And don't put a horse in just to see how he's going to come up, because you always forget that's why you put him in. Now, Tommy over here puts an asterisk. And like if he always wants to put in his horse that's going to be the pace setter, even though he knows it can't go all the way, because he wants to see what it'll do with the synaptic response system. But he puts an asterisk next to its name, so he knows that it's only in there for that purpose. All right, the final question. The most dramatic question we pose before this math audience is one in which we ask you gentlemen to use your extreme wisdom and tell us what you think the state of racing will be 5 years from today, or 4 years, 3 years, around the corner. What's the future of racing?
I think it's bleak. And something's got to be done. In I know in California there's a move to reduce the number of racing, do something like that fairly soon. Because we're facing 6 and 7 horse fields constantly. A few years ago, we were facing 8 and 9 horse fields, and then before that, 11 horse fields. So the trend is in the wrong direction. And unless something is done, unless something is done from a customer education standpoint, because there are a few racetracks that I've been to that I'm really pleased with that do genuinely try to educate their customers. In Southern California, that is absolutely nonsense. They just do not do that. The horsemen and the racetrack owners are in such worlds of their own that the fan be damned. And unless something is done about that, I mean, I am very interested. This is how I make my living. This is how a number of you do that. And unless something is done about that, we're going to be making a meager living in 5 years. I hopefully something will be done.
I think future racing is in simulcast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shutting down some of the smaller tracks, getting higher quality horses, and simulcasting.
I think I agree with Jimmy, and I am appalled, not because the racetracks don't cater more to the fan. I think they do enough for the fan. They provide us with office space, and I don't mind the take and all that stuff. That is, they can take 25%, but you see what you get. But I do think that anything which takes away from the sport or demeans it any further, what we're doing, the handicapping, is disastrous. But I do agree that despite Tom's gloomy picture of that, and it's a very good one, very accurate one, that the simulcasting, especially allowing the Indians to do it, because Jimmy and I are both part Indian, we're going to get our own place. 4 miles from my house will be a place where I can bet. And added to this is the fact that in a town like Banning or Beaumont, you wouldn't expect to find very many handicappers, but it's going to make more handicappers. They're going to, by it being there, they're going to go there and get interested in racing. So the more of these simulcast places you have, and out-of-the-way places, and no place is farther out of the way than where I live. We just got our first Edsel dealer last week. And those people start getting interested. Dennis the Minister here is the only guy I ever met who knew what a horse was within 20 miles of me. He was a bartender, and I was so lonely in that town, I started talking horses with him. You know, when I start talking horses, I'm desperate. So we didn't have much people, but that place is going to attract hundreds and hundreds of people who were never handicappers or tried to be before. And every place across this nation where one of these smaller establishments is open via simulcasting, it will be the resurgence of an interest in this sport. Would you like to say something on an upbeat now, Tom, since you predicted this horrible doom?
Well,
say something sweet and nice. This is your...
No, I'm just hoping they'll do something about it. You know, my hopes are high.
Oh.
But on the current trend,
The outlook is not positive.
The New Yorker says, for he has high hopes. High hopes, high in the sky, everybody.
You realize this is what you're listening to now is keeping you from getting to the race book.
He'll be appearing
at the lounge at 7 o'clock tonight and catch his act then.
We're actually quitting at half.
I know.
I see what they've got here. I don't think that's much.
When that guy sang one of the Frank Sinatra standards the other night, and that was just disgraceful.
This has been a large audience and a very much of a, more of a mixed audience than we've ever had before, more newcomers than we've ever had before. And I want to congratulate you as an audience for blending together, trying to understand that's what you didn't understand before, blending of people who just had no knowledge of this methodology and those who had a lot of knowledge. And showing your patience when we were a little bit too esoteric for you. And for those of you who were into the esoteric elements, showing your patience when we tried to deal with a very beginner level. Usually the audience claps for the speakers, but in this case, saying goodbye, let us applaud you.
Thanks for coming, everybody.
Does that mean we're out of here? I think we're out of here.